the warrant was carried out, Blackmon told The Intercept. Mainstream national media have so far demonstrated little interest in the case, potentially because of the severity of the allegations and charges against the boys. The Canton shootings in August, for which both boys have been charged, along with a 17-year-old who is the brother of one of the boys and another 24-year-old man, resulted in the death of two people, including a 6-year-old boy, and injured another man. The boys are presumed innocent until proven guilty, but law enforcement agencies and media, including local outlets that covered the arrest, aren't framing them as such. Despite the fact that the boys are minors, numerous local outlets printed stories with their full names, and some included their mugshots. WLBT reported the boys' names are suspects in the August shooting prior to their arrest. The treatment fits into a dangerous pattern in which the media portrays young black boys as menacing adults, an approach that has shaped the coverage of arrests and high-profile police killings of black men for decades. The footage goes on to show the officers take Harris' godsister to the ground and handcuff her while she's lying on her stomach. Officers ask her to identify one of the boys, who is handcuffed nearby, while she tries to explain that she is house-sitting. One officer slaps her on the back of her shoulder while she is face down on the ground. Another officer tells her that they are both going to jail. A third officer repeatedly tells her to shut up. "I think you are making me dumber," he says. "Shut up, goddamn." Later in the video, an officer leads a second shirtless boy out of the house. In the background, one officer slams the first boy to the ground. As the officer walks with the second boy, another officer strikes him across the face, making a loud noise and drawing blood as the boy cries out. Both Harris' godsister and the boy who was struck said the officer was holding a black object in his hand. It's unclear from the video footage that what, if anything, the officer is holding. To see law enforcement or any adult do that to a child is very hurtful and very shameful. "You don't do that to anybody. You don't treat nobody that way," Harris' godsister told The Intercept. She said she wants to see the officer held responsible and prosecuted. "Because you're supposed to be upholding the law, I mean you're supposed to be there to serve and protect, but you come out and you harm. So I want to know how you're gonna uphold the law when you are breaking it yourself." Several weeks before the arrest, the task force appeared in a strange video from Dark House Press in a website in Mississippi dedicated to a return to old school crime reporting. Images of allegedly confiscated paraphernalia and footage of people being arrested for various traffic stops and drug possession play over a rock music soundtrack. Advertisements flash for local gun stores, pest control services, and propane delivery. The video describes Operation Washout, an initiative aimed at getting lawbreakers off the streets and focused on gang enforcement and violent crime in Jackson. Dark Horse Press advertises itself as a news site, but the video, which highlights one officer famous for his speeches to young people about the staying out of trouble, reads more like public relations for law enforcement. Other stories on the Dark Horse site highlight crimes and arrests in Mississippi. Marshal Service task forces have faced increased scrutiny in recent years for the number of people they kill during arrest. A February analysis from the Marshall Project found that between 2015 and 2020, U.S. Marshals, task force members, or local police assisting in a Marshall arrest shot 177 people, 124 of them fatally. Seven more people died by suicide after being shot. Harris and her lawyer filed a tort claim against the officer, the first step to filing a lawsuit in Mississippi. Harris said of the murder charge, "My child is standing accused of something he did not do. He wasn't resisting arrest. They were in handcuffs. It was traumatizing," said her godsister, who added that the officers left the house in shambles and broke dishes. She was afraid they came there to kill her. "I have a lot of issues now. I don't sleep. I jump at every loud noise. I'm scared to sleep in the dark," she said. Asked what she would like to see happen to the marshals, Harry said, "I want them fired."
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of Al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam Al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام: وقد سأله رجل فأجابه، فقال الرجل: إن الفقهاء لا يقولون هذا. قال: يا ويحك، وهل رأيت فقيها قط؟ إن الفقيه حق الفقيه الزاهد في الدنيا، الراغب في الآخرة، المتمسك بسنة النبي صلى الله عليه وآله.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam was once asked the question by a man, to which he duly replied, and to which the man then retorted, "The jurists do not say this." The Imam said, "Woe unto you! Have you ever seen a jurist? A real jurist is a person who is ascetic from this world, who craves for the hereafter, and strongly holds unto the tradition of the Prophet."
Yeah. Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. In the various conversations and beautiful dialogues that Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, had, we find that he talked quite a bit about akhlaq. And akhlaq, of course, is morals and ethics. In these conversations, he put forth these beautiful pieces of wisdom and advice and knowledge when speaking with his companions and his friends and his relatives and the people in general. In one such conversation, he was asked by his companions to define humbleness for them. And so Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam said in reply in this conversation that humbleness is that you should be satisfied with the humble sitting place. Humbleness is that you should greet whoever you meet. And humbleness is that you should leave the dispute even if you are right. So going a little bit deeper into these statements about humbleness from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam in this conversation, we find that the first thing that Imam al-Baqir said was that we should be satisfied with the humble sitting place, meaning that our homes, the place where we sit, is referring to our homes. Our homes should be humble. They shouldn't be extravagant. They shouldn't be extra luxurious. Now, we're not saying that it should be uncomfortable. No, it should be comfortable. It should be a happy setting. It should be a satisfying setting, you know. But it shouldn't be luxurious. It shouldn't be extravagant. It shouldn't have, you know, things which we would call israf, extravagance, you know, plates of gold and silver or pipes of gold and silver and the like. The next thing that Imam al-Baqir said about humbleness was to greet whoever you meet. Now here, of course, this means to not be arrogant. If a poor person comes and greets you, you should greet them. If somebody who is older than you comes, you should greet them. If somebody is younger, you should greet them. So in general, don't be arrogant when you meet other people. Greet them. And finally, Imam al-Baqir says that humbleness is that you should leave the dispute even if you are right. Now here, when he means dispute, it means that when you realize the other person is not going to listen to you, you realize that the other person is not going to take what you're saying into consideration, the other person is not willing to listen to the truth, then at that point, even if you are right, don't continue to dispute, because it just turns into an unnecessary argument. Beautiful words of advice. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
His birth is just before the events of Karbala in the year 57, and he lived for 57 years, out of which about last 19 years were the time of his imamate. One of the important things about him is that before I go to the an example of his status as the Alim of Ali Muhammad is concerned, is his family line. He is unique among the Imams. From his father's side, he is Muhammad bin Ali, bin Hussein, bin Ali wa Fatima. From his mother's side, he is Ibn أم عبدالله بنت حسن بن علي وفاطمة. It's from both sides of the father and the mother, it goes back to Ali and Fatima. And therefore he was known as Alaviyun Bain al-Alaviyin. Means he's an Alavi total from both sides of his father as well as his mother. So his father Ali Zain al-Abidin is son of Imam Hussein. His mother Umm Abdullah is the daughter of Imam Hassan. So what is the relationship there? They are first cousins. That's not the topic tonight, don't worry. But just want to make a point here that, you know, marriage between first cousins is not an issue, you know, discouraged or abhorred or makruh in the Islamic Sharia. No, it is there. It is the seerat of the Aim also. Of course, we do not believe that the marriage should only be within the family, only between the cousins. Or, you know, cousins have a right on one another. No, there is nothing like that. But there is nothing which says that cousin marriage is discouraged unless it becomes a secondary issue. If things have been going on, you know, from one generation to another, to third, to fourth, to fifth, and then the physical deficiencies and some of the hereditary traits multiply negatively, then it becomes a secondary issue. Then because of the secondary reasons, you should refrain from marrying within the same family. Otherwise, by itself, there is no abhorrence or karahat at all in the Islamic Sharia as far as marriage between the first cousins is concerned.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. After Donald Trump's defeat, there was a measure of hope among Republicans who oppose him that control of the party would be up for grabs and that conservative pragmatists could take it back. But it's become obvious that political extremists maintain a vice-like grip on the national and state parties, and that the process of fielding and championing House and Senate candidates in next year's elections. The article you're about to hear has been written by Miles Taylor and Christine Todd Whitman. Miles Taylor has served as Chief of Staff at Department of Homeland Security. Christine Todd Whitman was the Republican Governor of New Jersey from 1994 to 2001. She also served as head of the Environmental Protection Agency under President George W. Bush. The article has been published as an opinion piece by the New York Times. It is titled, "We Are Republicans, There's Only One Way to Save Our Party from Pro-Trump Extremists." Stay with us for more. After Donald Trump's defeat, there was a measure of hope among Republicans who opposed him that control of the Republican Party would be up for grabs and that conservative pragmatists could take it back. But it's become obvious that political extremists maintain a vice-like grip on the national and state parties, as well as the process for fielding and championing House and Senate candidates in next year's elections. Rational Republicans are losing the party civil war, and the only near-term way to battle pro-Trump extremists is for all of us to team up on key races and overarching political goals with our longtime political opponents, the Democrats. This year, we joined more than 150 conservatives, including former governors, senators, congressmen, cabinet secretaries, and party leaders, in calling for the Republican Party to divorce itself from Trumpism, or else lose our support, perhaps with us forming a new political party. Rather than return to founding ideals, Republican leaders in the House and in many states have now turned belief in conspiracy theories and lies about stolen elections into a litmus test for membership and running for office. Starting a new center-right party may prove to be the last resort if Trump-backed candidates continue to win Republican primaries. We and our allies have debated the option of starting a new political party for months, and will continue to explore its viability in the long run. Unfortunately, history is littered with examples of failed attempts at breaking the two-party system, and in most states today, the laws do not lend themselves easily to the creation and success of a third political party. So for now, the best hope for the rational remnants of the Republican Party is for us to form an alliance with Democrats to defend American institutions, defeat far-right candidates, and elect honorable representatives next year, including a strong contingent of moderate Democrats. It's a strategy that has worked. Donald Trump lost re-election in large part because Republicans nationwide defected, with 7% who voted for him in 2016 flipping to support Joe Biden, a margin big enough to have made some difference in key swing states. Even still, we don't take this position lightly. Many of us have spent years battling the left over government's role in society, and we will continue to have disagreements on fundamental issues like infrastructure spending, taxes, and national security. Similarly, some Democrats will be wary of any pact with the political right. But we agree on something even more fundamental, foundational, democracy. We cannot tolerate the continued hijacking of a major U.S. political party by those who seek to tear down our republic's guardrails and who are willing to put one man's interests ahead of the country. We cannot tolerate Republican leaders in 2022 or in the presidential election in 2024 refusing to accept the results of elections or undermining the certification of those results should they lose. To that end, concerned conservatives must join forces with Democrats on the most essential near-term imperative, blocking Republican leaders from regaining control of the House of Representatives. Some of us have worked in the past with the House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy, but as long as he embraces Donald Trump's lies, he cannot be trusted to lead the chamber, especially in the run-up to the next presidential election. And while many of us support and respect the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, it is far from clear that he can keep Donald Trump's allies at bay, which is why the Senate may be safer remaining as a divided body rather than under Republican control. For these reasons, we will endorse and support bipartisan-orientated moderate Democrats in difficult races, like Representative Abigail Spanberger of Virginia, and Elissa Slotkin of Michigan and Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona, where they will undoubtedly be challenged by Trump-backed candidates. And we will defend a small nucleus of courageous Republicans, such as Liz Cheney, Adam Kinzinger, Peter Meyer, and others who are unafraid to speak the truth. In addition to these leaders, this week we are coming together around a political idea, the Renew America Movement, and will release a slate of nearly 24 Democratic, Independent, and Republican candidates we will support in 2022 midterm elections. These renewers must be protected and elected if we want to restore a common sense coalition in Washington, but merely holding the line will be insufficient. To defeat the extremist insurgency in our political system and pressure the Republican Party to reform, voters and candidates must be willing to form non-traditional alliances. For disaffected Republicans, this means an openness to backing centrist Democrats. It will be difficult for lifelong Republicans to do this, akin to rooting for the other team out of fear that your own team is ruining the sport entirely. But democracy is not a game, which is why, when push comes to shove, patriotic conservatives should put country over party. One of those races is in Pennsylvania, where a bevy of pro-Trump candidates are vying to replace the departing Republican Senator Pat Toomey. The only prominent moderate in the primary, Craig Snyder, recently bowed out of the race, and if no one takes his place, it will increase the urgency for Republican voters to stand behind a Democrat, such as Representative Connor Lamb, a centrist Democrat who's running for the seat. For Democrats, this similarly means being open to conceding that there are certain races where progressives simply cannot win, and acknowledging that it makes more sense to throw their lot in with a center-right candidate who can take out a more radical conservative. Utah is a prime example, with the best hope of defeating Senator Mike Lee, a Republican who defended Donald Trump's refusal to concede the election, is not a Democrat, but an independent and former Republican, Evan McMullin, a member of our group, who announced last week that he was entering the race. We need more candidates like him prepared to challenge politicians who have sought to subvert our Constitution from the comfort of their safe seats in Congress. And we are encouraged to note that additional independent-minded leaders are considering entering the fray in places like Texas, Arizona, and North Carolina, targeting seats that Trumpist Republicans think are secure. More broadly, this experiment in coalition campaigning, uniting concerned conservatives and patriotic progressives, could remake American politics and serve as an antidote to hyper-partisanship and federal gridlock. To work, it will require trust building between both camps, especially while fighting their side by side in the toughest races around the country by learning to collaborate on voter outreach, sharing sensitive polling data, and synchronizing campaign messaging. A compact between the center-right and the left may seem like an unnatural fit, but in the battle for the soul of America's political system, we cannot retreat to our ideological corners. A great deal depends on our willingness to consider new paths of political reform. From the halls of Congress to our own communities, the fate of our republic might well rest on forming alliances with those we least expected to. Thank you.
This is A to Z. An Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson, Divine Chastisement. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Divine chastisements are indeed reflections of man's actions as well as the consequences of his sins. Sometimes they appear as an unpleasant situation in material life and sometimes in spiritual matters, such as the lack of enthusiasm for worship and invocation to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But the worst punishment meted out is that of making a person hard-hearted. The heart becomes devoid of humanitarian feelings, philanthropy, and sympathy, and leads to perpetration of cruelty and many other sins. Imam Baqir alayhi salam has said, God chastises man for sins and disobedience through the spirit and the body, indigence in livelihood, indolence in worship, but God has not punished any servant with something worse than hard-heartedness. Brothers and sisters, there are different types of punishments from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. When He punishes a human being, it is based on the reasons that the human being brings about for himself. Allah is not unjust. He does not want to punish you, and He has given you the rules to follow. But we, the human beings, we become negligent. We become worthy of those punishments and those chastisements, let it be in this world or the hereafter. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the topic of divine chastisement, and we said that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not want to punish human beings, but He has defined the rules. If anybody violates those rules, this means it's their decision that they want to bring Allah's punishment and chastisement into action. So, in order for us to be able to save ourselves from this chastisement and this punishment, we need to follow the rules. It's as simple as that. Now, we can have very complicated discussion on the topic, but honestly, it is a very simple thing, right? Yes, I do realize and understand it's not easy to live a life where we can save and secure ourselves from Allah's punishment. But at the same time, brothers and sisters, you have to have faith. It's not that difficult either. You just have to be careful. You just have to be conscious about everything you do in your life. And God forbid, the worst of the chastisement that Allah has put for all of us, according to the traditions of Islam, is the hard-heartedness. Hard-heartedness is something after which, if God forbid somebody becomes a victim of it, after this, a person is not open to divine guidance anymore. His heart is not welcoming of truth and justice. Now, this is difficult. This is hard. And who is responsible for this hard-heartedness? It is us, ourselves. We bring it upon ourselves through our actions and inactions in some cases. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parsetoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
in the limelight.
Britain's early handling of the coronavirus pandemic was one of the worst public health failures in Britain's history, with ministers and scientists taking a fatalistic approach that exacerbated the death toll, a landmark inquiry has found. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists Ian Sample and Peter Walker. The piece is titled COVID Response, One of UK's Worst Ever Public Health Failures. Britain's early handling of the coronavirus pandemic was one of the worst public health failures in Britain's history, with ministers and scientists taking a fatalistic approach that exacerbated the death toll, a landmark inquiry has found. Groupthink, evidence of British exceptionalism, and a deliberately slow and gradualist approach meant the United Kingdom fared significantly worse than other countries, according to a 151-page Coronavirus Lessons Learned to Date report led by two former Conservative ministers. The crisis exposed major deficiencies in the machinery of government, with public bodies unable to share vital information and scientific advice impaired by a lack of transparency, input from international experts, and meaningful challenge. Despite being one of the first countries to develop a test for COVID in January of 2020, the United Kingdom squandered its lead and converted it into one of permanent crisis. The consequences were profound, the report says. For a country with a world-class expertise in data analysis to face the biggest health crisis in 100 years with virtually no data to analyze was an almost unimaginable setback. Prime Minister Boris Johnson did not order a complete lockdown until 23rd of March 2020, 2 months after the government's SAGE committee of scientific advisers first met to discuss the crisis. This slow and gradualist approach was not inadvertent, nor did it reflect bureaucratic delay or disagreement between ministers and their advisers. It was a deliberate policy, proposed by official scientific advisers and adopted by the governments of all of the nations of the United Kingdom, the report says. It is now clear that this was the wrong policy and that it led to a higher initial death toll than would have resulted from a more emphatic early policy. In a pandemic spreading rapidly and exponentially, every week counted. Decisions on lockdowns and social distancing during the early weeks of the pandemic and the advice that led to them rank as one of the most important public health failures the United Kingdom has ever experienced, the report concludes. The report stresses this happened despite the United Kingdom counting on some of the best expertise available anywhere in the world and despite having an open, democratic system that allowed plentiful challenge. The report from the House of Commons Science and Technology Committee and the Health and Social Care Committee draws on evidence from more than 50 witnesses, including the former Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, the government's chief scientific and medical advisers, and leading figures from the Vaccine Task Force and NHS Test and Trace. It celebrates some aspects of Britain's COVID response, in particular the rapid development, approval and delivery of vaccines, and the world-leading recovery trial that identified life-saving treatments, but is highly critical of other areas. Some of the most serious and early failings, the report suggests, result from apparent groupthink among scientists and ministers which led to fatalism. Greg Clark, the chair of the Science and Technology Committee, said he dismissed the allegation that government policy sought to reach herd immunity through infection, but the outcome came to be seen as the only viable option. It was more a reflection of fatalism, Greg Clark said, that if you don't have the prospect of a vaccine being developed, if you think people won't obey instructions to lock down for very long and have a wholly inadequate ability to test, trace and isolate people, that is what you are left with. The impossibility of suppressing the virus was only challenged, the MPs say, when it became clear the National Health Service could be overwhelmed. The report questions why international experts were not part of the UK scientific advisory process and why measures that worked in other countries were not brought in as a precaution, as a response was hammered out. While Public Health England told the MPs it had formally studied and rejected the South Korean approach, no evidence was provided despite repeated requests. We must conclude that no formal evaluation took place, which amounts to an extraordinary and negligent omission given South Korea's success in containing the pandemic, which was well publicized at the time, the report says. The MPs said the government's decision to halt mass testing in March of 2020, days after the World Health Organization called for painstaking contact tracing and rigorous quarantine of close contacts, was a serious mistake. When the test, trace and isolate system was rolled out, it was slow, uncertain and often chaotic, ultimately failed in its stated objective to prevent future lockdowns, and severely hampered Britain's response to the pandemic. The problem was compounded, the report adds, by the failure of public bodies to share data, including between national and local governments. Further criticism is levelled at poor protection in care homes for Black, Asian and minority ethnic groups and for people with learning disabilities. Professor Trish Greenhalgh of University of Oxford said the report hinted at a less than healthy relationship between government and its scientific advisory bodies. It would appear that even senior government ministers were reluctant to push back on scientific advice that seemed to go against common sense interpretations of the unfolding crisis, she said. It would appear that SAGE, COBRA, Public Health England and other bodies repeatedly dismissed the precautionary principle in favour of not taking decisive action until definitive evidence emerged and could be signed off as the truth. Jonathan Ashworth, the Shadow Health Secretary, said the report was damning. Hannah Brady of the COVID-19 Bereaved Families for Justice Group said the report found the deaths of 150,000 people were redeemed by the success of the vaccine rollout. The report is laughable and more interested in political arguments about whether you can bring laptops to COBRA meetings than it is in the experiences of those who tragically lost parents, partners, or children to COVID-19. This is an attempt to ignore and gaslight bereaved families who will see it as a slap in the face, she said.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Eulogy recitals are a special and unique artistic phenomenon. The 3rd of February, 2021. Another aspect is the content of your eulogy, which is a combination of thinking, feelings and emotions, religious, historic and social information, and familiarity with the needs that the audience has. Notice that in today's performances, which were very good examples of eulogies, one's viewpoint about the affairs of the world and our own country was accompanied by religious and Islamic teachings. And this is an easy task for eulogists. It is second nature to them, and it shows the outstanding nature of this art form. The subject matter that the eulogists work on is the best or one of the best subject matters. This is because eulogists praise the best role models of the universe, praising Muhammad and his household, greetings and peace be upon them, and repeating their lessons and evoking their memory. With what you are doing, you constantly evoke their memory and do not let them be consigned to oblivion. You draw people's sentiments to their lessons, their words, and their lifestyle, whether the occasion is about their birth or their martyrdom. Therefore, the subjects discussed by the eulogists are really outstanding subjects. Another important task that you carry out is creating a culture. In other words, reviving the memory and names of the Imams, peace and greetings be upon them, and the Holy Prophet, greetings be upon him and his household, is an act of creating a culture in society, and of promoting the ideas of those great personalities. This is a very good task. This is in fact expanding the Nabawi, Alawi and Fatimi lifestyle. You are promoting their lifestyle through your endeavor. Therefore, the issue of eulogists is a very important issue and an outstanding and valuable phenomenon. Fortunately, it is growing on a daily basis. In other words, this phenomenon is growing in our country each and every day.
From all the ways that were wrong, indeed you Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
After taking power, the Taliban leaders reached to the Shia community seeking their support and allegiance. The Taliban officials said their government will include all Afghans and social justice will be protected.
Today's Shia people are safer than before. We don't let any individual hurt you. You are from Afghanistan and have equal rights. The Islamic Emirate recognizes you as part of Afghan society.
The Shia Ulama Council at a press conference on August 24 urged the Taliban to ensure that they will treat all faiths and ethnicities with equality and justice.
Ball is hard.
We are happy that U.S. forces have left our country. Congratulations to the Afghan nation. In the meantime, we demand and recommend that the Taliban fulfill their promises by forming an all-inclusive government.
During weeks under the Taliban rule, many people from the Shia community have reportedly been displaced in Dikandi and some were massacred by the Taliban in Ghazni and Dikandi, Amnesty International confirms. At the same time, the Daesh still takes lives from the community. Nearly 300 Shia worshippers were killed and wounded in Kunduz blast on Friday. Following this tragic event, Shia Clerics Council in Afghanistan once again urged the Taliban to investigate the deadly attack and take massacre of Shia seriously, as well as call for unity among all Muslims.
Shias are making 20% of the population of Afghanistan. The Taliban can't establish an inclusive Islamic government without giving equal role to us. We also condemn the catastrophic attack in Kunduz and urge the Taliban to bring its perpetrators to justice.
After taking power, the Taliban promised the formation of an inclusive government and providing a safe ground for all Afghans. But Shia minority is concerned that the threat of Daesh terrorist group is being ignored by the Taliban. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Czech Prime Minister Andrej Babiš is the most high-profile politician in the EU to be exposed by the Pandora Papers leak earlier this month. It was revealed that Babiš, who lost a re-election bid just last Saturday, spent €19 million using tax haven companies to buy a chateau in France. The scandal has just been debated in the European Parliament.
Andrej Babiš behaves again as a hypocrite, as a liar, as a person despising democracy, but this time also as a businessman doing shady transactions.
Hundreds of current and former politicians, celebrities, religious leaders, and drug dealers have used so-called shell companies to hide their wealth and investments.
Madam President, I am livid.
A consortium of journalists from around the world compiled a report containing 12 million leaked documents, dubbed the Pandora Papers.
As countries scramble for millions to fund health and social services, $11 trillion are out of reach offshore.
Most of those avoiding tax are based in the West. EU leaders who talk a lot about values are accused of hypocrisy.
Why is the United States, which is not cooperative, again not mentioned, whereas in the Pandora Papers it's very clear that the United States are becoming a bigger and bigger problem?
Experts warn the issue will never be resolved unless the rich and powerful develop a conscience.
I think that the ultimate question in the end is individual ethics, and living by good example, by those, who actually want to defend the system. And without that, the best monitoring, the best legal framework, the best regulation can't save you.
Legislators say a big problem relates to the amount of money politicians and policymakers can generate for themselves.
Where action could but isn't taken, there's obviously no political will to stop mass tax evasion by the super rich.
Revelations like these are nothing new. Lawmakers say it proves European Commission policies in this area are not working, and therefore it is simply a matter of time before more scandals come to light. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Karim Abu Salim crossing, the only crossing into the Gaza Strip for import and export, is under the control of Israel. It keeps imposing restrictions on movement and trade process. The Israeli closure of Kerem Abu Salem threatens the economic sector of the Gaza Strip. These threats come in light of the catastrophic economic and humanitarian conditions that the residents of the Gaza Strip have been experiencing for more than 15 years of siege and closure.
About 90% of the Palestinian economy depends on the agricultural sector that is going through many disasters these days, including the continuous wars on Gaza, especially the 2021 escalation. Repeated closures of Kerem Abu Salem crossing has negatively affected all aspects of life in the Gaza Strip.
To voice their anger at Israeli restrictions, Palestinian farmers and traders gathered at Kerem Abu Salem crossing, the only way for their crops to be sold in markets abroad.
We have lost our money in vain due to the Israeli restrictions. Israel is pursuing a policy aimed at destroying our economy and making us isolated from the world. We demand an urgent help to export our crops to the West Bank and abroad.
Palestinian farmers and traders also expressed the crossing closure as an aggressive act that reflects Israeli insistence on besieging 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
By depriving us of exporting our crops, Israel intends to create chaos in our life. This has already affected our economy and made our life harder. I don't see any promising future for my family.
In light of the Israeli closure of the only crossing in the Gaza Strip, Palestinian farmers and traders who depend on exporting crops for a living are calling on the international community to make action and stop these restrictions that cause serious financial losses. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Thousands took to the streets of Brussels on Sunday to try and apply pressure on heads of governments in the EU to be more decisive when it comes to climate change. It was the biggest protest of its kind since the coronavirus pandemic took hold in the 27-nation bloc.
There's a sense of urgency between young people, elderly people. We are the grandparents for the climate.
There is no plan B. Actually, this is the moment to change our habits.
You are young and you change the world, and I'm here for change the world.
Droughts, fires, tornadoes and floods hit regions around the world during the summer, and scientists say fuel emissions are to blame. There was plenty of criticism handed out to EU leaders during the Brussels event.
Our politicians are not seem to be hearing what we say.
Since the first marches, the political language has changed a bit, but not enough at all.
All these people in the street are necessary to tell politicians, be ambitious, because we're going to vote for you.
They're waiting too long. We have to agree with a lot of different countries.
Campaigners warn there will not be many more next generations if greater impetus is not applied to dealing with the crisis, particularly from big carbon emitters like the US, EU and China.
We have to work together, Europe and the whole world.
We should have been here more people to show that we all want change.
With my friends, we're studying in science. We want to fight and change